From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Linda Wertheimer, and this is On Point. Today, rafting the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon is a family-friendly vacation, but 150 years ago, it was a death-defying adventure. The explorer, John Wesley Powell, led the first documented trip right through a canyon few white Americans had even dared enter. This hour on Point, one man's perilous adventures through the Grand Canyon and his prophecies for the West now. You can join us on air or online. Have you been to the Grand Canyon? What sticks with you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook on Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is John F. Ross. John is a historian and author of The Promise of the Grand Canyon, John Wesley Powell's Perilous Journey and His Vision for the American West. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. John, welcome to the radio program.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me.
I want you to tell me when and how you decided that you wanted to write about this man, John Wesley Powell.
Well, Linda, you know, as a kid, I read his story of going down the river through the canyon, you know, unknown waters, four tiny wooden rowboats and 10 determined men.
It sounds really like something from one of the landmark books that you're talking about.
Oh, I mean, it really just thrilled me as a kid. And, you know, later on when I worked at Smithsonian, I stumbled over his work in anthropology, his work with Indians. And I started to kind of begin to wonder about, you know, this guy who, you know, went down this, did this incredible exploration with one arm, but that went on to become this incredible visionary about the land. And, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald said there are no second acts in American history. Well, this guy had second and third and fourth acts. And I kind of thought, well, I have really couldn't get my hands around it and did not read a biography or anything about this guy that kind of made sense about, you know, he had no college. He had college education, didn't graduate from college, Midwestern kid. You know, who was this guy?
Well, now, you are also, I believe, a canyon fan. I assume that must have had a little something to do with your decision to write a book about it. You have gone on rafting expeditions way inside the canyon in some of the areas similar to what John Wesley Powell did.
Absolutely. Linda, you know, I'm a real advocate for, you know, when I write about my subjects, I really like to go over the ground. And I certainly had to do the canyon run, and it's an extraordinary thing. And it really opened my eyes, and it was a real key to unlocking Powell and, you know, who he was and what he became.
You, as I understand it, I saw some parts of the canyon that regular, ordinary old rafters don't necessarily get to see. Do you think you saw the Grand Canyon as Powell did?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, though there's a dam on one end and a dam on the other end, so it really is the Colorado through there was really a canal, virtually, because the water is released by these dams. So the water is cold now, not warm the way it was with Powell. Remarkably enough, it looks pretty much the same as it did when he went down. There is a little more vegetation along the sides because there aren't big floods that go through anymore. But largely, you're within the maw of these extraordinary canyon walls that shoot up 6,000 feet at points. So you were really out of touch with electronics. And there's really virtually no other way to get out aside from going through to the end.
There are parts of the canyon which you write about where Mr. Powell and his boats were in very fast water with those sheer canyon walls that go up a tremendous distance. That's why they talk about Powell going into the canyon a mile deep into the earth.
It's really extraordinary, Linda, because, you know, you start out at Lee's Ferry, the beginning of the canyon, you go, and the traditional trip you take today, you go 250 miles through, you start at this Kaibab limestone. It's this pretty kind of soft white rock. It's 250 million years old. It's the time when T-Rex was running around. And you begin to descend into the earth, and the cliffs rise up and up and up. And until that Kaibab limestone is 6,000 feet above your head, you have to crane your neck to see it. You go through 19 different rock layers, and you get down to what they call the basement rocks. I love that, basement rocks. They're almost 2 billion years old. They're some of the oldest exposed rock on the surface of the earth. And you really feel as you go along the river that you're not just going through, you know, this incredible river, but that you're descending into the history of the earth.
John Wesley Powell kept journals, as you would imagine, during his courageous expedition into the depths of the canyon. And in the 1960s, the U.S. Geographic Survey had actor Henry Alcott read excerpts from the journal in a film which celebrated the anniversary of the exhibit. We have that here.
We are now ready to start on our way down the great unknown. We have but a month's rations remaining. We are 3/4 of a mile in the depths of the earth, and the great river shrinks into insignificance as it dashes its waves against the cliffs.
That was Henry Alcott, who was an actor. He read that excerpt for the U.S. Geographic Survey for a film celebrating the anniversary of John Wesley Powell's expedition. Now, he was, I guess, to some extent, underestimating. I mean, he was not in the deepest part of the canyon when he wrote that, or perhaps he didn't really know how deep it was. What do you think?
Well, it's really interesting, Linda. You know, so he was finishing what Lewis and Clark had started 70 years ago. And the only part of unexplored America was this 100 by 300 mile section of canyon lands. It's Zion and Bryce and Grand Canyon, these names we know now. But then it was just this terrible place that it was very hard to get through. So nobody really knew what. So when Powell got himself together to go through, he took rations for 10 months and included a barrel of nails and hammers to build a cabin when the water would ice over, right? Well, it never iced over. I mean, it was just that was the least of their problems. It was so hot. They didn't know if the water would cut under the earth. They heard about that. But the biggest thing, of course, Linda, is they just didn't know if they were going to encounter when these rock walls were rising up so much, giving them no exit.
And there's no way, no way to walk ahead and see whether that kind of roaring sound you could dimly hear was maybe a waterfall? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, waterfall. And then and in 2 minutes, it would be all over. And, you know, a few weeks in, they had 4 boats. They lost their first boat in a rapid. It was just chewed up into little pieces. And they lost a third of their food and their equipment. And, you know, it just started getting a little worse on that front. The rain and the water started getting their flour wet. So they got their mosquito netting out to get all the green mold out. And every time they did that, they had less and less and less. And so this 10 months of rations, it took them 3 months to get through. By the end, they were starving. They were just, you know, when they had few clothes
left. Well, we'll get to that.
Oh,
but
boy.
Let's go back to the beginning of Mr. Powell's life, which I think was marked certainly by two huge events. One was the Civil War and one was the Grand Canyon. What do you think? What do you think left the biggest mark on him?
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that because early on, I think a very profound effect on him was his father, who was a Methodist preacher. And they moved when Powell was a little boy to Jackson, Ohio, and this was in the 1830s, right near the Ohio River, which was where the border with Kentucky, where the slave state versus the free state of Ohio. And I discovered that that Powell's father was an abolitionist in a time when abolitionism was a dirty word. Emerson called them angry bigots, right? A lot of people thought that slavery wasn't necessarily such a good idea, but the whole idea that the abolitionists were talking about black and white equality, was really, really upsetting to people. And this young boy grew up in that. He got stoned at school for his father's beliefs. They had their house painted in the middle of the night and their horse had its tail cut off, and they were harassed for his father's abolitionism. And I think that had a really, really profound effect on him. It made him feel like an outsider. It also gave him great empathy later on to understand about Indians and about Mormons and the world, and to ask new questions, fresh questions about the world around him.
And we are going to get to that, and we're going to go back and talk about some of the other things that happened in John Wesley Powell's life. John Wass, stick around. We're reimagining John Wesley Powell's perilous Grand Canyon journey and his vision for the American West, and you can join the conversation. Can you imagine this ride in the canyon? Tell us about your ride through the canyon. We head into the break. Of course we're going to do this. You know we'd have to do this with Grand Canyon Suite, composed by Ferdy Grofel. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and this is On Point.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes the most important things need a hype squad.
Corporate.
Income.
Tax.
Corporate income tax!
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy. A very enthusiastic podcast about the economy.
This is On Point. I'm Linda Wertheimer. We're talking about the American explorer and scientist John Wesley Powell, who took the first documented trip into the Grand Canyon, through the Grand Canyon, and gave the Grand Canyon its name. You can join the conversation. Did you grow up on tales of Western expeditions like Powell's? Did they spark a sense of adventure? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest today is John F. Ross. His book is The Promise of the Grand Canyon, John Wesley Powell's Perilous Journey and His Vision for the American West. And you're going to like this caller who has reached out to us from Brookings, South Dakota. Ginny, hello.
Hello, my name is Jeannie.
Jeannie, could you just tell us about your connection to the canyon?
Yes, my great-grandfather was Stephen Vandeveer Jones, who was part of the second expedition of the Colorado River. They started at Green River, Wyoming, and went through the canyon and on the Colorado River. He was a topographer. He got connected with them first because he was a school teacher and principal of a school in Washburn, Illinois, with A.H. Thompson, who was John Powell's brother-in-law. And he said, my grandfather, great-grandfather, was good at math and good at mapping, so he could be part of this second expedition, which is the one that was credited with the more scientific long-lasting measurements and things with the canyon.
For, among other things, family, the reason that John Wesley Powell's equipment was lost when one of their boats was smashed to bits. So what kind of thing did your great-grandfather save from that day?
Well, he lost the boat, I think, running the first expedition.
Yes, that's what I meant. Yes.
There were three, and my great-grandfather was the head of the second boat, the Nellie Powell. At any rate, the things we took to the Grand Canyon Museum in March were a rubber bag of his that held all of his equipment, a collection of his surveying instruments, protractor, compass, things that looked to a ruler that looked like it was from ivory, a celluloid protractor. We took a couple of booklets of his that he had begun with paper still in them and maps that he had begun drawing. We also took some moccasins that he had traded with Native Americans that they met along the way. His diary is in the New York Public Library, and some of his translations of the Paiute language are in the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History.
Well, now,
so I just want the second expedition to get some credit too.
Absolutely. Well, you're quite right, and we're very glad that you called. It's a privilege to hear from someone who is directly connected. John Ross, you wrote about the second expedition and the fact that it happened, and also the fact that I believe that it just didn't get the kind of attention that it really deserved to get.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Linda. Thank you. It's great to hear that story from the caller, because the second expedition actually was the real one that got important science done. At the end of the first one, which we'll get into more, I guess, he came out, he was alive, he was a hero, and he could have rested on his laurels. But secretly, in his heart of hearts, John Wesley Powell knew that the first expedition had been a failure. I mean, he got out alive, certainly. But he had lost all his maps, he had lost all his readings, he had broken all his barometers, and he was not happy. So what did he do? He turned around and set up an expedition to go right back and to do it right, because that was what had drawn him, not the heroism of going through the canyon, but really the opportunity to, describe this extraordinary feature in a North American landscape.
Well, now, what do you think when he finally came out of the canyon that first time, and before he went on the more, as you say, the more sort of rational version of his expedition, what do you think was the most important finding of this journey? What did he learn that he didn't know?
Well, you got to remember at that time that geology was kind of the particle physics of the day. It was exploding all sorts of traditions and barriers. People generally thought that the world was about 6,000 years old in the early 19th century. And here were people beginning to talk about it being many tens of millions of years old. And that was the thing that opened up for Darwin to start talking about evolution. So when Powell went down the Grand Canyon, and he started seeing these all sorts of changes. He said when he went down, it was like reading a book. He read as he went. He could see that there were great inland seas that had come over the continent. He could see these great tectonic things. He could see all these really interesting things that were happening and suggesting that the Earth that we see, which seems static and not changing, it's not that way at all. It's changing all over the place. So as a result of his trip going down there, he invented the science of geomorphology, which is really to look at how geologic activities shape the contours of the topography, how rivers and uplifting and all that. So no longer was just geology looked at in rocks, but it was looked at on the surface. And so that was a very big push that he made. And and then the seed of all of this, of course, as we'll talk about later, led to his really, really revolutionary ideas about sustainability and climate.
Now, when we think about the Grand Canyon now, we have, obviously, you can fly over it. You can walk into it. It's somewhat tamed, although not entirely tamed. But seeing the canyon whole was something that had never happened. And to some extent, John Wesley Powell was able to bring that out of the canyon with him.
Absolutely. So You know, conquistadors, hundreds and hundreds, some of the first North Europeans to the continent had come up to the lip and looked in it and turned away in horror and said, nobody wants to go here. It's a place where nothing good can happen. And that was pretty much the feeling by everybody generally up till Powell's day and up until Powell. And Powell, so on his second expedition, Powell brought in photographers. Later, he would bring a very famous landscape painter to the canyon. He, in his writings, he started to change and was the real linchpin in changing this idea that the Grand Canyon, which was not a horrible place that would eat you alive and to be shunned, but in fact, it was this extraordinary thing. It was really part of American exceptionalism. It was iconic. He really changed that so that and that's kind of what my title teases out, The Promise of the Grand Canyon, that it kind of unlocked the Grand Canyon and it really helped America understand who it was.
Now, who actually had, you said the conquistadors looked over the rim and thought, never, not going there. But what about the Indians who lived in the canyon? There must have been in prehistory and even up until the time that that people like Powell intervened into the canyon, there must have been lots of Indian explorers. There must have been people who lived there and they knew the canyon. Am I right?
Absolutely, Linda. You know, so when he went down, one of the surprises were at certain points, you know, not in the inner canyon, but in a lot of other points, he found signs of Indian habitation. He found, you know, pottery and painting and some habitation, you know, some rock set up and in house broken up house formations and things like that. So, no, there had been people who had pushed in. Certainly the Native Americans had been in there, I think, during some different climate times. But it's tough down there. And another thing that he found out, as the Native Americans down there found out, too, that the game that he expected to kind of supplement his diet was not really available. So it's a pretty, you know, it's all rock and water and open to flash floods and all sorts of heat and terrible winds. And it's not a place that, you know, this you would think about moving, you know, building
it's not,
a house
not in. Idyllic.
No, not at all.
But as the people who thought it was dangerous were actually quite right. It was dangerous. And I suppose, depending upon where you go into it, still is. I wonder, one of the things that interested me in your book, a friend of mine who was on the Grand Canyon Trust and obviously knows a lot about the canyon and its history, read your book, and he said that he thought you had done a lot of work on a mystery of the Grand Canyon journey, the first journey, that three men who had been a part of the expedition one day decided to leave it, and they walked away, and they were never seen again. And you did a lot of additional sort of detective work on that.
Absolutely, Linda. This remains one of the enduring mysteries of American Western history. You know, these guys were on all together. These were Powell had picked these tough mountain men. He didn't pick military officers. He didn't pick professional surveyors. He had a gut instinct.
He certainly did pick one little short guy with only one arm.
Yeah,
himself.
Right, exactly. Himself, exactly. But he picked these tough mountain guys who could be, and it turned out a brilliant, brilliant choice because they just didn't know what they were going to hit. So he needed men who were adaptable and had good spirits and had seen stuff before. So they went in and the privations were awful. Their campsite caught on fire. A couple of them caught on fire. They ran out of, you know, virtually ran out of food, all for coffee except for a couple pounds of flour. They couldn't hunt. Their hands were just blistered and cut up and their backs hurt. I mean, it was just the clothes rotted off their bodies and they had lost, and so they were half naked. It was a rough go. And right towards the end of the Grand Canyon, of course, they didn't really know where the Grand Canyon was going to end. Three of them, of their crew decided there was a little break in the rock and they had hit just one more bad rap. And I mean, it's so loud, Linda, that you just can't hear yourself talking. And they just, I think it just, you know, they just said, no more, we're done, we're not going to make it through there. Instead, we are going to, without any water containers, with very little food, they had some ammunition and their guns, they were going to walk 75 miles through the desert to a Mormon settlement that they knew generally where it was. And there was no animosity when they left. And they weren't cowards. They just kind of, you know, they decided that they'd had enough and this was a better option. And, they took off and nobody ever saw them again.
What do you think happened to them?
I think that there are all kinds of theories that most prevalent, and an Indian chief acknowledged this, that they were killed by Indians. And I think, frankly, what happened is these men turned up in this destitute desert area without any food, without any animals. And I think that Indians came across them. And I think that there was a big misunderstanding of some sort. And the men died. Those things happen kind of all of the time. And you can't really blame the Indians for looking at, you know, where did these guys come from and what were they doing? So that's probably what happened. I mean, there are some intriguing conspiracy theories about the Mormons, but there's no conclusive evidence really whatsoever about that. You know, they certainly could have just died on their own too, just run out of water.
And no bits and pieces of them were found?
No bits and pieces at all. There was kind of rumor that one of the guys who stayed on the trip had given his pocket watch to one of them to take to bring to his sister. And there was rumor that it had floated. Somebody saw it somewhere. But again, this is the stuff of the tall tale West. That same guy who had given the watch, the other guy who kept on there, I uncovered, felt so badly that he had not encouraged those three guys to stay on, that 30 years later, he went to right along the water where they had all been, and he castrated himself out of guilt. It was an incredible one of those things that researching and you find something like that and you go, wow, you don't expect it and it comes up and slaps you in the head. This is history that is not black and white, I tell you.
Let's just take a moment hear from Isabel, who's calling in from Brooklyn, New York.
Hi, Linda.
Hi, Isabel. Tell us your story.
How are you? Oh, well, my mind is just blown from that last piece of history about the fellow. I never knew that. But I rafted down the Grand Canyon 2 years ago with my stepmother and a group of their friends from Colorado. We went with an expedition group. And we went down almost the entirety of the river, with the exception of the last 33 miles. It took us 6 days because we had motorized engines on the J-Rig. So usually I think it takes about 2 weeks. And, my dad was he absolutely was fascinated with everything John Wesley Powell. We used to go to Lake Powell, and so this trip was in honor of him. And the entire history of these guys going down what we did and the fact that they were in these boats and they had no idea where they were going and these rapids that we went through, which were just absolutely monstrous. And our guides, they know how to go through there. And then just the heat and the dryness, I can't even imagine what that experience must have been like. For me, it was one of the greatest things I've ever done.
Well, I recommend this book to you.
I can't wait. I can't wait to read the book. I absolutely can't wait to read it. The one book that I've read is The Green Mile, which is about the guides that went down and the Dories, kind of reliving what he did. So there was a lot of history with Powell, and he was just what a tough, tough, tough guy. I'm so excited you guys are talking about this because I feel like not everyone knows what the Grand Canyon is and what it means and what your speaker was just talking about. What it means to the U.S., this icon of just absolute majesty. Yeah.
We're going to talk a lot more about that, what it means and what it has meant to American history. Thank you very much for sharing your vision of the Grand Canyon with us. This is On Point. I'm Linda Wertheimer. We're talking about an American explorer, John Wesley Powell. He made science the government's business. You can join the conversation. In modern times, every drop of the Colorado River is used by somebody. You may be one of them. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and this is On Point.
Hey, thanks for listening to this podcast. I'm Peter Sagal. Come try the only show that treats the news the way it deserves to be treated, roughly, with lots of tasteless comments. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Linda Wertheimer. We're discussing how John Wesley Powell prophesied some of the predicaments that face the American West today. You can join the conversation. Have you lived through a drought in the West? Living through one now in other parts of the country? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking to John Ross. He is the author of The Promise of the Grand Canyon, John Wesley Powell's Perilous Journey and His Vision for the American West. And we're going to be joined in just a minute by a journalist who writes about the way water is managed today. But first, I want John Ross, if you could just tell us about the famous map that John Wesley Powell made based on his journeys through the West, his map of watersheds.
Well, yeah, Linda, that's an interesting story. He took a map while at the U.S. Geological Survey, his cartographers did under his direction, of the American West. And it looks like you take a paintball with different colors and a paint gun and you shoot at a map. And there's these splotches, these rounds, some are large and some are small. And this map is an extraordinary new way of visualizing back then of America. It was watersheds, right? And so he was suggesting that instead of looking at political lines in terms of the development of the West, kind of traditional state lines, that we in fact look at where water is and all of those things. And so really he, with this extraordinary map, which he presented to the Senate in 1890, it was an extraordinary, revolutionary new way of looking at our land in a new way.
Do you think that it was inspired, or he was inspired to do this work by the trip through the canyon?
Absolutely. I was confirmed. I think he saw, and this whole science of geomorphology that I mentioned, I think he began to see that human beings were very, very temporary on this land in terms of geologic time. And he saw the relationship between water and changes in the land and tectonic activity. And I think that opened him up to start thinking about, okay, as after the Civil War, as America put down their rifles and looked west to develop this land, wasn't an Eden, and how are we going to develop it and manifest destiny, this great surge of American feeling that they were going to race across the continent and take what we needed and build this great promised land. And Powell said, well, that's great. I believe in that. But wait a second. There's not enough water out there, and we need to be careful. And it wasn't just that he was saying that it was arid. He was concerned about monopolies, about litigation, about droughts, about little farmers getting crushed by droughts and spindly crops and bankruptcies. So he was really, you know, saying, look, we need to think about moving on to this land, this beautiful land, in a sustainable way. What can we do? How can we grow our nation in this? And it wasn't a message, quite frankly, that anyone wanted to hear.
But an extraordinary thing that that a man of his era, which was, you know, which, as you said, manifest destiny, the notion that man, especially the white man, could just pretty much do whatever they wanted over the land. I was amazed by Powell and his foresight. Extraordinary.
Absolutely. I mean, this was at a time Mark Twain, you know, joked, you know, steal it if you can, take it if you must. I mean, this was the time, you know, go. And there, you know, and he got shut down ultimately by the railroad magnates that had a lot of money and, you know, the development of the West as this verdant Eden and Western senators who wanted people to move out there. And then, of course, there were the immigrants who wanted to move out. They wanted to get their 160-acre plot, which had worked very well in the Midwest. The government gave every the Homestead Act.
Right.
You got 160 acres, and if you could show that you could make it productive, then it was yours.
So it was a whole view of the West that John Wesley Powell had that was sort of in conflict with the vision of the West, not based on data, that many other people had. Now, joining us from Pullman, Washington, is Emily Benson. She's a journalist for High Country News. She writes about water management today. Hello, Emily.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Now, let's just take a moment here to reconsider the Colorado River, which carved the Grand Canyon. And as I understand it now, every drop of that river is used in our modern world. And you, Emily, you can probably tell us who's using it.
Right. So the basin is, it covers parts of 7 states in the United States in the Southwest, and it also covers part of Mexico. So nearly 40 million people in that area depend on this river for their water, and it's also used to irrigate nearly 5.5 million acres of farmland. And you're right, we do use every drop of it. The river hasn't actually met the ocean since the late 1990s, except for 1 year in 2014, and that was when officials released a pulse of water specifically for the purpose of reconnecting the river with the ocean. Except in special circumstances like that, we use up the whole river these days.
California Governor Jerry Brown talks a lot about the urgent need to save water in his state. Governor Brown is everybody knows, is a conservationist, and he takes a very strong view of what his state ought to be doing. Here he is talking to PBS NewsHour in 2015.
We're talking about people taking out their lawns, using all these other different water-saving technologies, and then accelerating things like desalinization. And almost every way conceivable, Californians have to get used to a very different world, and we're going to have to live just a little bit differently.
Or maybe a lot more differently, since California is getting drier and drier. Isn't that right, Emily?
Yeah, that's right. So the entire Southwest is getting drier, getting hotter because of climate change, and that's making it drier. And what the experts are starting to say, what I'm hearing, is that it might not even be useful to use only the word drought anymore, because that implies a temporary period of hardship that we just need to tighten our belts and get through it, and then we can go back to the way things have been. But actually what we're seeing is they're calling it aridification. The climate of the region is just getting drier, and we're going to have to get used to that. And that's going to take some awareness, which we're starting to see, and then also some changes in behavior.
Now, John Ross, John Wesley Powell's vision for the development of the West for he used a term. It wasn't the arid West, but it was something like that. He had a vision for how it ought to be developed in watersheds. What did his West look like? What was his vision?
Well, so, you know, here is this guy who had fought during the Civil War and fought and bled to keep the Union together. What he was, first and foremost, was a real patriotic national American. And he was really concerned, and I think Emily was mentioning this, about where we are, what might happen where we are today, which is that the Colorado River is the most litigated river in the world. And he felt that water should be kept within its local confines, and that the local people on the ground should be the people making the decisions about how the water is used and who's using it. He was very much a proponent of the kind of Jeffersonian idea of the agrarian, the small farmer, and that that's where really good decisions lay. And even though he was this federal bureaucrat, which most people, a lot of people would know him at, he was a real proponent of the small farmer. And he was really concerned. So that's where he started moving the conversation, way, way ahead of his time. So things like bioregionalism, localism, all of this, these kinds of things that he brought up now are in the discussion.
What do you think that he had even the vaguest notion that one of the biggest cities in the United States would be in Southern California?
No, and, you know, he would have been horrified, too, about the size of the mega dams and what those had done. I mean, he was very much, again, person of his times who believed that small dams and things, but I don't think he could have just have imagined the size of the of these cities and the technology that is being used to move water hundreds and hundreds of miles. You know, and the technology now that the aquifers, you know, the great bodies of kind of underground water, the fossil water, that increasingly as the surface water gets drier and drier, people are drilling deeper and deeper and deeper. And this water, the Ogallala Aquifer and others, you know, have accumulated over many millions and millions of years. And while they might get a kind of a little fresh breath from a big snowpack or something, they're not generally being replenished. So we're, you know, undergoing this kind of thing that he would have you know, he was kind of right on top of.
Emily Benson, do you think that we're paying the price for ignoring the wisdom, the prophecy of John Wesley Powell?
Yeah, I do think that this is something that we need to accept. But I think that there's also, you know, there's reason for hope. You know, during the recent California drought, Californians they decreased their water usage by a quarter or more. So there is a lot of places where we can change what we're doing and have enough water to go around.
So what do you think the immediate future of the West, of your part of the West, Emily Benson, what does it look like?
Well, we know that we're already seeing the effects of climate change. The river is already shrinking, and the scientists I've spoken with say that they expect that trend to continue. They say that the river could drop by 35% to 55% by the end of this century. So the thing that I hear from them is that climate change is water change. So if we want to deal with this problem, we need to deal with climate change.
Do you think that there was any suggestion that John Wesley Powell might have anticipated anything like climate change? He didn't know about that, did he? He didn't think about that?
No. You know, of course not. Nobody really knew about that. And, you know, he died in, 1902, and 30 years later, we have this extraordinarily huge environmental catastrophe, the Dust Bowl. And in Washington, D.C. in 1934 and 1935, this huge cloud of soil, topsoil from Nebraska and Oklahoma, blows into the East Coast, and it darkens the sky in Washington, D.C. It begrimes the federal office windows. People are just stunned. This is tons and tons, right? And this has resulted from the indiscriminate plowing of the West and by many, many farmers. And it was this event, this just horrific event of all this dust blowing, imagine that, that forced really the senators who were talking about what to do about this to put together the Soil Conservation Service to build, put in place places that windbreaks to stop all of this. And one thing I'm hoping is, as we hear Emily talk about, you know, the increasingly what's going to, our future is going to face, that it's not going to take you know, a huge tragedy like that dust storm blowing in to make people realize that we really need, as Powell articulated so coherently 150 years ago, that we need to pay attention to what the land is telling us. We need to see what is there and listen to it and pay attention to climate.
He had quite a career as a scientist after the Grand Canyon. And one of the things that I thought was very impressive was that his view of what was happening was that rather than accept the vision of manifest destiny, this is our land and whatever we want to do, we can do, he said, you know, vision without data is just not what he wanted to do. He was interested in science. That was his attitude.
Absolutely. And, you know, if he were alive today, you know, he would be in front of the Senate talking about climate change with a stack of data under his arm. And, you know, I think that the same things that shut him down last century is the same thing that is kind of still here when people debate climate change. And there's a kind of a sense that if we pay attention to the land and if we talk about climate and we talk about human activity on the land and how that affects things, that it's somehow standing in the way of American progress. And I think that Powell would be the first to say, no, it doesn't stand in the way of progress. That sustainability, working with the land, thinking about these things, mapping the land, looking at it from a scientific point of view will actually help America reach its goals as opposed to being in the way.
Emily Benson, do you have any kind – you said that you feel somewhat optimistic about the possibility that we could one day do the right thing by the land?
Yeah, so there are a lot of people are working really hard on this problem. And within the Colorado River Basin, it's sometimes the way it's managed, it's sometimes split up into the upper basin and the lower basin. And both of those areas right now are working on what they call drought contingency plans, which are just agreements between the states to figure out how to share cutbacks on their water use. So that's...
That's optimistic, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
So, John Ross, do you think this is something that Powell would have? I think this is going to be a yes or no answer, something that
absolutely. I mean, I think he was a patriotic American. He felt that we focused on something, we could get it done, and I think he would be in the forefront of that today.
Thank you very much. John Ross is the author of The Promise of the Grand Canyon, John Wesley Powell's Perilous Journey and His Vision for the American West. Emily Benson from High Country News, thanks to both of you for joining us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, gentrification. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and this is On Point.